This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Of an increasing number of private military contractors by the CIA and other military...
Hi, this is Jim Hightower. Whenever I'm in Portland, I get my daily dose of local, national, and world news from KBOO.
In the past, the case officer would have gone into some very dangerous areas on his own, but today they seem to require an entire personal security detachment to go into certain places, be it Mexico, Libya, Yemen, wherever. So, it's happening. I don't expect it to stop anytime soon.
Brandon Webb, is there a difference in the approach of the Bush administration onto the Obama administration in how they deal with special operations? And now, your thoughts on special operations in a democratic society?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate we don't live in a world where that's peaceful. I mean, I think inherently we would all like to live in that world. We live in a world where they're bad people, and I think special operations has a vital role in fighting what really to me is we're really up against a radical ideology. We can call it a war on terror, but it really doesn't boil down to that, in my opinion. And
has Obama shifted focus from Bush, or would you say it's a continuum?
I think it's a continued effort, and if anything, he's been more effective at using JSOC and United States Special Operations Command to deal with a lot of these emerging threats.
And it's gained momentem under his administration.
Yeah. The problem I see, and the point I want to make, is
we have 5 seconds.
A key component to that's missing is, what are we doing to prevent the spread of radicalism and embracing these different cultures? Because without the prevention, we're in a whack-a-mole.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to continue part two of our discussion and post it online at democracynow.org. Jack Murphy and Brandon Webb, authors of Benghazi, The Definitive Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Hermann Schick. Thanks for joining us. Happy birthday, guys, as well.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th annual Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will be broadcasting live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park for the Portland metro area and throughout the state with our partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Salem, Warm Springs, and more. Internet listeners can tune in to KBOO.fm. Again, that's the 26th annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should be hungry. More information on costs, benefit to KBOO members, performing artists, and more can be found at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Hello out there. This is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial, unless your FM was made in America.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the $4.5 billion bridge project between Portland and Vancouver has been called off indefinitely after Washington legislature failed to raise the needed funding.
New documents reveal that Monsanto had stored genetically modified wheat in Colorado until 2012, contradicting their earlier claims that they destroyed all the test wheat 10 years ago.
And millions of Egyptians head to the streets to challenge the consolidation of power by President Mohamed Morsi. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, July 1st, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Ani. The Columbia River Crossing, the multi-billion dollar project to replace the Interstate Bridge, officially died this weekend. The conservative-controlled Washington State Senate declined Friday to approve a transportation revenue package that would have provided the project with the necessary funding. Subsequently, Washington Governor Jay Inslee and Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber officially shut down the project. The CRC offices in downtown Vancouver are closing, and local residents and legislatures are considering their next steps. Several alternatives to the mega project have been proposed, most prominently the construction of a third bridge over the Columbia River, which supporters claim is more useful and less expensive than replacing the current bridge. Oregon and Washington spent a combined $170 million on planning for the CRC over almost 10 years.
The new academic year kicks off today for every school district in Oregon, and their first homework assignment is due. Every district has to submit at least preliminary plans for a new teacher evaluation system. And while many teachers support the new system, they are concerned about its effectiveness due to timeline and budget restrictions.
Kids won't be back in the classroom for a while yet, but July 1st kicks off the new school year in Oregon. It is also the deadline for districts to submit plans for a new teacher evaluation system mandated by the state legislature. A few districts started early and developed pilot programs. Aaron Whitlock, who has helped with some of the pilots for the Oregon Education Association, says there was supposed to be one more year to test the new systems, but the timeline changed, leaving many schools scrambling.
Technically, I presume that most districts will be able to turn in the paperwork. You know, the homework is due, they'll turn it in, but is it going to be as thorough and as thoughtful as they would have liked? You know, no, I don't think it is going to be as thoughtful. If we were all graded on our homework, I don't know that we'd all earn A's.
One of the larger districts that worked on a pilot is North Clackamas, where Robin Trokey is a high school teacher. She says educators and administrators collaborated on the new system and thinks it creates solid standards for excellence in teaching. In the real world, however, she says they may be tough to achieve when school budgets are tight.
Unfortunately, the standards and actually the ideal of teaching is built on a far more resourced system than what we currently have in the state of Oregon. That is definitely a challenge when you have very full and very crowded classrooms.
The new evaluation system is supposed to define effective teaching and analyze how teachers relate not only to their students, but to the staff members they work with. The legislature passed a 2011 law requiring districts to come up with new performance standards that hold teachers accountable based on more than just their students' test scores. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Casey Decker.
Today in Salem, the House of Representatives secured the largest investment ever made in Oregon's public schools. The new education budget will provide Oregon's 197 school districts with $6.75 billion for the upcoming budget cycle, a $1 billion increase over the current funding levels. House Majority Leader Val Hoyle spoke enthusiastically about her belief in prioritizing Oregon's children and turning the tide for the school funding in the state. In a statement, she remarked that, quote, "It will take a time to undo all the damage caused by years of disinvestment in public education." Through the state, school districts have been forced to make deep budget cuts in recent years, including over 7,000 teacher layoffs. Democratic Representative Lou Frederick of Portland called the day a historic moment, adding that prioritizing education funding was a clear obligation. The $6.75 billion comes from a direct appropriation of $6.5 billion, with an additional $200 million in savings from the Public Employees Retirement System, or PERS. Senate Bill 5519A, Oregon's Education Budget, passed the House 53-5 and now heads to Governor Kitzhaber for his signature.
Oregon has become the first state in the nation to hold charities accountable to their missions by eliminating tax subsidies for those who mismanage funds. The new measure eliminates state and local tax breaks for nonprofits and charities that spend less than 30% of donations on programs and services over a period of 3 years. House Bill 2060 was signed into law by the governor last month. In 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that laws restricting charities from soliciting for funds violated their First Amendment rights. This means that states like Oregon, which previously had laws prohibiting charities that mismanage money from soliciting, has to take a different approach. The Department of Justice spokesman Jeff Manning said the new Oregon law would likely stand up to a legal challenge because it doesn't restrict speech. The Oregon Department of Justice identified the charities that were paying themselves and their fundraisers exorbitant amounts of donated money, with some charities using less than 3% of funding for actual programs and services. These organizations are using a nonprofit as a cover for what's basically a for-profit firm, quoted Jim White, executive director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. Oregon has over 17,000 charities registered to legally solicit, with about 23% of them based out of state. Officials think that this law will directly affect less than 100 organizations overall.
This morning in Salem, the Oregon Senate passed a bill that will increase penalties for animal abuse. But Senate Bill 6 also includes a provision that is opposed by many animal welfare groups in the state because it threatens the ability of smaller animal rescue groups to function. An online petition that was created yesterday garnered hundreds of signatures before this morning's vote, but was not entered into testimony before the vote was cast. The animal rescue groups ask why they should be targeted as part of a bill on felony animal abuse when these groups save thousands of Oregon animals every year. They say that individuals and small groups rescue animals who are rejected by government shelters and humane societies and who would otherwise be euthanized or remain on the streets. That bill passed the Senate and will now go to the House for approval.
An internal investigation into a statewide dental health report has found no wrongdoing by state employees. The probe by the Oregon Health Authority Human Resources Department sought to determine whether there was outside influence on data or delay in releasing the 2012 SMILE survey. The survey was the third in a series of periodic assessments to address the most common childhood disease, tooth decay. The survey presents the findings of oral screenings of first, second, and third graders attending Oregon's public schools. The 2012 survey released last April this year by the Oregon Health Authority documented improvements in all major dental categories since 2007. The 2007 survey found a 49% increase in untreated dental decay among children between 2002 and 2007. But this year's report detected a reversal in that trend. The report also shows that the percentage of children with untreated decay has dropped below levels in 2002. The report's findings run counter to arguments made by pro-fluoridation advocates who claim that fluoridating Portland's drinking water would be necessary to improve dental health. Residents rejected the city council's proposal to fluoridate Portland's water in the May 2013 election by more than 20% margin.
The genetically modified wheat found in Oregon last month is likely to have come from a government facility in Fort Collins, Colorado. That's according to documents obtained by Reuters news agency Today. In 2005, over 1,000 seed varieties were shipped to the Colorado facility, which can store viable seeds for decades. The USDA confirmed that the genetically engineered wheat was stored at the National Center for Genetic Resources Preservation Facility until early 2012, when Monsanto directed the wheat to be incinerated. In the weeks following the discovery of genetically engineered wheat in eastern Oregon, Monsanto had tried to shift blame from its own corporate practices. This included suggesting environmental activists may have planted the wheat themselves as an act of protest. Environmental groups called this claim ridiculous, pointing out that every known instance of sabotage of genetically modified crops has involved their destruction. There has never been a case of activists planting the crops they oppose.
A report released today by Food and Water Watch connects the rapid growth of genetically engineered crops with the rise of herbicide-resistant superweeds. These superweeds have led to the steadily increasing use of more dangerous herbicides. Despite being genetically engineered with the sole purpose of helping farmers fight weeds, crops such as Monsanto's Roundup Ready corn have spurred a crisis of weed management for farmers nationwide. The report's author said that for nearly 20 years, herbicide-tolerant GE groups have been marketed as a way to improve yields, lower costs for farmers, and reduce agriculture's environmental impact. But, she says, not only have these claims not held up, they've backfired and led to a chemical arms race doing incalculable harm to the environment and human health. The study looked at data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency, analyzing the use of herbicides in U.S. agriculture. The report shows that herbicide use on corn, cotton, and soybeans has grown steadily by 26% in the years between 2001 and 2010. The report also examines the costs associated with GE crops and herbicide-resistant weeds. Farmers face significant costs from reduced yields and reports to combat weed infestations, and pesticide exposure and chemical residues harm the environment, public health, water quality, and wildlife.
A bill known to local activists as the Oregon version of the Monsanto Protection Act is currently being discussed in the House Rules Committee, which convened at 5 p.m. in Salem. If passed, Senate Bill 633 would prevent individual towns and counties from regulating the planting, production, and sale of genetically engineered crops and products. Backing the bill are cleverly named advocacy groups like Oregonians for Food and Shelter, which actually are lobbyist groups for biotech giants that produce genetically modified seeds. Food activists in Southern Oregon say that they believe the bill is meant to target a planned vote in Jackson County, Oregon, that would ban genetically modified crops in the county. The state bill, as a preemptive attack on efforts by residents of Jackson County, which is near the California state line, to force a vote that would ban the planting of genetically engineered crops in the district. Senate Bill 633, should it pass, would render any regulations on genetically modified crops, not just bans like the one proposed in Jackson County, illegal.
You are listening to the Cable Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news after this newscast, followed by Labor Radio, a local program focusing on issues of the working class at 6. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, focusing on local and national prison issues. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is hot, with a high of 91 degrees and 0% chance of rain.
It is 5:17, and that means it's time for the Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Thank God for Congress, right? When things get out of balance in America, we can always count on our legislative stalwarts to recalibrate the scales of justice. Take greed, for example. The Wall Street barons who wrecked our real economy with their greed-fueled casino games are playing the same games again while pushing Washington to let them keep their public subsidies, fat bonuses, and special low tax rates. So our Congress critters turn their legislative guns on avarice. Unfortunately, their aim was a bit off. Instead of popping the overprivileged, Congress hit the most unprivileged Americans, people on food stamps. "Too many families are getting food stamps," they shrieked, driving the cost of this poverty program to record levels. Yoo-hoo! Knuckleheads, record numbers of our people are on food stamps today because, guess what? Record numbers of them are unemployed or underemployed and have been knocked all the way down into poverty. Yet, the Tea Party Republicans now ruling the U.S. House are demanding cuts of as much as $25 billion a year in food stamp benefits, which would prevent some 13 million Americans, half of them children, from receiving the program's groceries. Representative Michelle Bachmann rose in a biblical falsetto to rationalize this. "If anyone will not work, neither should he eat." Hello, Michelle. That's not quite what Jesus said. Also, many of these people are working, but not paid enough to make ends meet. And many more are desperately seeking jobs that aren't there. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fairness, though, the GOP did vote to give these food stamp applicants something. Drug tests. I don't recall that Jesus at the Sea of Galilee required anyone to pee in the cup before getting fishes and loaves. And if he had done so, he would have required the bankers to take the first cups.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
In his weekly address Saturday, President Obama continued to push for a plan he announced earlier last week to address and combat climate change. Obama's energy secretary responded to criticism from the fossil fuel industry by assuring them the new climate change plan isn't a war on coal. KBOO's Jenga Soderberg sat down with Sarah Higginbotham of Environment Oregon to talk about what must be done at a local level to address climate change.
Could you mention the impact of climate change on the state of Oregon, especially if it is left unchecked and continues on in the direction that it's going right now?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think this last year is a really sort of landmark example. The entire country was hit by, you know, in certain parts of the country, scorching heat and continuing drought. As I already mentioned, we've seen devastating wildfires right here in Oregon, the largest in over 100 years. And then, of course, what we're also seeing is reduced snowpack. And so what that's leading to is more flooding and actually throughout the year, less available water. So these are real and direct impacts that Oregon's experiencing. And as we continue to feel the effects of carbon pollution that's affecting climate change, those storms and that extreme weather is only going to get worse. So that's, you know, sort of what we're facing. And then that's, I think, in large part why it was so important to see the president of the United States actually stand up and, you know, sort of put aside any doubts or claims that this isn't really happening. And that was really encouraging because here in Oregon, it's not only our beautiful spaces that are under threat, but it's also our economic livelihoods and so many other aspects of the way that we live here in the state.
At the state level, we've had a positive response from Governor Kitzhaber to President Obama's statement. What is Kitzhaber's 10-year plan as far as addressing climate change in the state of Oregon?
Yeah, Governor Kitzhaber released his 10-year energy plan earlier this year, and that was an exciting move from his office. They have focused on a few things, one of which is energy efficiency, so making sure that new energy that we're using in state-owned buildings is being met by energy efficiency. And I think a key point to mention there is that they're focused on state-owned buildings, so they're actually leading by example. That's a really cool part of that plan. So energy efficiency, moving forward on small-scale renewables, whether it's solar or smaller wind projects or conservation efforts. So those are sort of key pieces of the governor's plan. And then just now in Salem, in fact, on the same day President Obama announced his new climate plan, Governor Kitzhaber signed into law a few new really key energy bills, including a bill that would increase energy efficiency standards for appliances in the state, along with a few others. So that was a nice syncing up of our progress here in Oregon with the president's leadership.
Now, I don't want to sound pessimistic, but we know that we need to get down to 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. We're at 400. Are these efforts too little, too late?
I don't think that's a good question, and I think you're sort of voicing the concern of so many of us. I think that, you know, what's pretty landmark about what the president announced is that he's actually going to be issuing a memorandum to the EPA to limit carbon pollution that comes from power plants. Now, power plants are the largest single source of carbon pollution fueling global warming, and his plan is going to map out a vision for actually finally limiting that. Right now, there's no checks or regulations on how much carbon pollution they spew into our atmosphere. So those strong standards will actually help drive the market towards energy efficiency and renewable energy sources. And when you couple that with support for energy efficiency and renewable energy, the entire plan really does have the potential to help us achieve the pollution cuts that we need. So I think it's a huge step in the right direction and the way we need to keep pushing. And then obviously long-term, the proof is really going to be in the pudding, and it's going to be up to activists and families and citizens to make sure that he makes good on his promises.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Higginbotham with Environment Oregon and their website, environmentoregon.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The effort by Republican lawmakers in June to evict the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism from their campus office space fell short yesterday when Governor Scott Walker vetoed the bill. The executive director at the center, Andy Hall, spoke with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan about the attempted eviction and what may have prompted Walker's veto.
What do you believe prompted the veto?
Well, we really aren't sure, but, you know, I certainly do thank Governor Scott Walker for acting in the best interests of the students here at the University of Wisconsin, as well as the university overall and the people of Wisconsin. In his veto message, the governor made mention of the fact that this is a measure targeting a specific organization. Maybe that factored into it. We had received some legal advice indicating that that type of a measure might in fact face some substantial legal hurdles if anybody decided to file suit. But fortunately, we don't even need to sort all of that out, thanks to the fact that he used his veto powers on this measure yesterday.
Did the move from Republican lawmakers early in June catch you by surprise at all?
It certainly did catch us by surprise. We were all asleep while the legislators were introducing this measure and moving it forward out of the legislature's budget writing committee. In fact, the identity of the lawmaker or lawmakers who came up with this idea still hasn't been publicly disclosed, and the reasons behind it have never been publicly articulated. You ask a reasonable question like, why was this thing shot down? We don't know that, just like we also don't know why it rose in the first place. There's a lot of mystery surrounding the entire episode.
And can you share with our listeners what the response was from the independent media community?
The response has just been astounding. We received more than 700 signatures on an online petition expressing support for the continuation of the collaboration between the Investigative Center and the Journalism School here at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. There were numerous statements of support issued by journalism organizations, by organizations that represent college professors across the country, many expressions of support pouring in from people across the country whom we've never even dealt with before. And by expressions of support, I mean letters to the editor that were published in newspapers, letters to the governor and legislators, and some increasingly now financial contributions coming into the center. Just yesterday, we announced the launch of a fundraising drive for our newly created education fund to strengthen the organization's training mission. We work hard to train the next generation of investigative journalists, and contributions to that fund have begun to pour in just today.
And I know that you disclose all of the groups that fund you.
Yes, we believe very strongly in financial transparency. That's been our policy all along. We disclose the identity of every funder on our website, and we also make it clear that funders cannot have any influence at all in our editorial operations. They have no role in our news coverage decisions. And it's a system that overall has worked very well to protect the integrity of our journalism.
What's next for the center?
I think we have some very bright days ahead. Thanks to the enormous amount of publicity that has come our way because of the legislature's secretive actions that were hatched in the dark of night, we now are a much better known news organization, and we hope to use this higher level of fame, I guess you could call it, to increase our ability to generate the financial resources that we will need to sustain our work and, in fact, to expand it. You know, and we certainly invite everybody to take a look at our website at wisconsinwatch.org. They'll see more than 100 stories we've produced over the past 4 years. We have some more coverage coming out this week that I think will focus scrutiny on decisions made by our government, and I think we'll be here for years to come.
I've been talking with Andy Hall, Executive Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
19 male firefighters, all members of the elite Granite Mountain Hotshots of Prescott, were killed Sunday in the worst wildfire tragedy for firefighters in the U.S. since 25 died in 1933's Griffith Park Fire in Los Angeles. It's also the worst incident for firefighters since 9/11, when 343 members of the New York Fire Department died. Erratic winds and dry grasses fed a lightning-sparked fire that tore through the communities of Yarnell and Glen Isla, about 80 miles northwest of Phoenix. An estimated 200 homes had been destroyed as of Sunday, when the fire spread to nearly 8,400 acres from 2,000 acres overnight. More than 400 firefighters were trying to contain the fire on three flanks, but officials said there was zero containment as of this early Monday afternoon. Weather Channel meteorologist John Erdman called the incident a nightmare scenario, with thunderstorms producing little rainfall, adding to shifting winds and lightning strikes. According to Mike Reichling, Arizona State Forestry Division spokesman, a major wind shift caused the central Arizona fire, which now spans almost 9,000 acres, to become erratic. The inferno proved too much, even for the shelters of the 19 firefighters that they carried as a last-ditch survival tool. Among the dead was Eric Marsh, superintendent of the Granite Mountains Hotshot, according to his father, John Marsh. Also killed, Kevin Wojcik, according to the Los Angeles County Fire Inspector, Tony Atkins. Bill Warnecki, according to his grandfather, Jack Warnecki. Chris McKenzie, according to the California State Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, for which his father worked. And Andrew Ashcraft, according to the Arizona Republic newspaper, which attributed the news to Ashcraft's wife. Southwest incident team leader Clay Templin says the crewman commanders were following safety protocols, but it appears the fire's erratic nature simply overwhelmed them. A tribute to the firefighters grew Monday outside Prescott Fire Station No. 7. Flowers, American flags, and signs were placed on or near events that separated the station from a road. Also left was a copy of the Firefighter's Prayer, which contains the lines, "And if, according to my fate, I am to lose my life, please bless with your protecting hand my children and my wife." Arizona Governor John Brewer called the loss unbearable during a Monday news conference and said she understood the pain people are dealing with. President Obama hailed the fallen as heroes. In a statement released as he prepared to travel to Tanzania from South Africa, Obama said on Monday, "Michelle and I all join Americans in sending our thoughts and prayers to the families of these brave firefighters."
1 year after Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi was democratically elected, the Egyptian people are again protesting in the streets, calling for his resignation. The protesters oppose the heavy influence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Morsi's cabinet and Morsi's decisions to direct more executive power towards himself. The military is stepping in on behalf of the protesters, giving Morsi an ultimatum: meet the protesters' demands within 48 hours or be forcibly ousted by the military. The military emphasized that it does not wish to take political power, but only is acting as an enforcer of the people's will. More on this later in the hour from Free Speech Radio News.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, July 1st, 2013. Israeli troops kidnap Palestinian civilians during dawn invasions targeting West Bank communities, and settlers storm Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped 9 Palestinian civilians during dawn invasions on Monday, targeting a number of West Bank communities. Palestinian sources reported invasions and kidnappings in the cities of Bethlehem and Hebron, southern West Bank, as well as Nablus and Tulkarim in the north. Troops searched and ransacked homes during the invasions before taking the 9 men to unknown destinations. The army gave no reason for the kidnappings. In related news, the Al-Ahrar Center for Detainee Studies and Human Rights reported on Monday that Israeli soldiers kidnapped 1,790 Palestinians in the first 6 months of this year. This number includes 300 who were kidnapped in June, and added that 16 Palestinians have also been shot and killed by Israeli military fire in 6 months. The Al-Ahrar Center said that dozens of women, children, elderly, legislators, intellectuals, and journalists were among those kidnapped. The center added that the arrests took place in every part of the occupied West Bank, including Jerusalem, in addition to 25 arrests in the Gaza Strip, including fishermen and 5 arrests on border terminals. In other news, a group of radical Israeli settlers and some 60 female Israeli soldiers stormed on Monday midday Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Old City. Local sources reported that Israeli police officers also provided protection for the settlers and the soldiers as they toured the Al-Aqsa Mosque. In a press release, the Al-Aqsa Association for Heritage announced that the daily invasions of settlers and soldiers targeting the Al-Aqsa Mosque are escalating and feared that this will pave the way for the settlers to take over the Muslim holy site. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 1st news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Taliban and other resistance fighters have killed nearly 300 Afghan local and national police in the span of a month. That's according to new figures released by the Interior Ministry. Ministry officials say that this illustrates how casualties among local forces are mounting now that NATO-led coalition troops have handed over responsibility for combat operations. An estimated 50 Taliban fighters were killed and over 70 injured in an attack on Sunday led by the Afghan army in the eastern Nangarhar province. These numbers were not immediately confirmed by a Taliban spokesperson. On Saturday, 22 Afghan and foreign Taliban were killed in a military invasion in the Logar province.
Hunger-striking Guantanamo detainees have filed a motion in U.S. federal court to stop the forced feeding they have endured for the last 3 months. The motion was brought by Guantanamo's last British resident, Shakar Amir, and 3 other prisoners who have all been cleared for release. Lawyers for the prisoners filed the lawsuit on Sunday in Washington, D.C. federal court. U.S. federal judges ordered the government this morning to respond to the case brought by force-fed detainees within 2 days. Al Jazeera News Network last month exposed the use of a drug called Reglan during the force-feeding process. When used for extended periods of time, Reglan can cause severe neurological disorders, including one that mimics Parkinson's disease. One of the prisoners who filed the lawsuit said in a statement that he is participating in the hunger strike of his own free choice, adding that hunger striking is the sole peaceful means that he and other prisoners have to protect their indefinite detention. He quoted that he does not want to die, but he is prepared to.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation.
Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Angelique O'Rourke, Casey Decker, John Rasmussen, and Stephen Charrett. Special thanks to Ross Freeman-Levin. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath 100.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Ani Raven Haynes. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's 7 o'clock, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host the Abe and Joe Talk radio show. And then at 9 o'clock on Alternative Radio, professor, author, and activist Robert Jensen speaks on A Call to Action.
At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on stage and studio, host Sarika Mehta presents a special on Vidit Latte, the director of the award-winning documentary Beyond Silence.
At 11:30 on Art Focus, hear Ava Lake, interviewing Sean Records, who has a show opening at Blue Sky this week titled Flaming Energy Mall. And thanks to KABU members for your generous support. If you are not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Ani.
Good night, John.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 1st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Commuters in the San Francisco Bay Area struggled this morning to reach their destinations after nearly 2,500 transportation workers went on strike at midnight. Antoinette Bryant is president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1555, one of the two striking unions that represent mechanics, train operators, and other Bay Area rapid transit staff. Bryant told KPFA Radio that an 11th-hour contract offer from BART was ridiculous.
They have put out rubber numbers on their budget that were not true. They said that in 2009, we gave back $100 million based on their claim that there was a $310 million deficit. The very next year, in an election year, they rolled fares back.
Yesterday, both sides said they were still far from agreement on salary, pensions, health care, and safety matters. European leaders responded with anger to newly leaked top-secret documents that indicate U.S. intelligence agencies bugged European Union offices in New York, Washington, D.C., and Brussels, tapping their phones and fax machines and accessing EU computer systems. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
The allegations were published over the weekend by the German magazine Der Spiegel and The Guardian newspaper in the UK. Both say the leaked documents came from fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. They reportedly reveal a series of U.S. programs aimed at intercepting communications among EU officials on a range of policy and trade issues. European reaction has been swift. Martin Schulz, president of the European Parliament, says if the allegations are true, it would represent a deep breach of trust.
It is shocking that the United States take measures against their most important and nearest allies, comparable to measures taken in the past by the KGB, by the secret service of the Soviet Union.
French President François Hollande said the incident threatens the upcoming U.S.-EU free trade negotiations. In 2001, the European Parliament investigated spying in Europe by the U.S. National Security Agency as part of the so-called Echelon Project. The report concluded spying for economic advantage could breach EU law. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has downplayed the controversy, saying he didn't know the details of the allegations, but that all countries routinely seek out information to protect their national security. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
Former national security contractor Edward Snowden remains in a Moscow airport where he applied for asylum last night. Russian President Vladimir Putin said today that Snowden would not receive asylum unless he stops damaging Russia's American partners. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The Texas State Legislature kicked off another special session at 2 p.m. today after attempts last week to pass far-reaching abortion restrictions were blocked by a Democratic filibuster and mass protests. As anti-abortion and abortion rights protesters converge on the Austin State Capitol this week, other states are waging legal and legislative battles over the issue. Ohio Governor John Kasich signed a state budget over the weekend that includes measures that defund family planning clinics and force women to get ultrasounds before getting an abortion. A law recently passed in Alabama to restrict abortion access was put on hold by a federal judge on Friday. These state battles progress as the White House threatens to veto a bill passed by the House of Representatives that would ban all abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy nationwide. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Thousands of demonstrators rallied outside the Capitol building in Austin, Texas on Monday, as the legislature reconvened to consider a sweeping bill to restrict access to abortion in the state. If passed, Senate Bill 5 would outlaw most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy and mandate regulations that would likely force most of the state's abortion clinics to close.
They're trying to decide what we can do with our bodies, and that's not okay with me. They don't know what's right for my body, only I do.
That's Texas-based activist Natalie Atwater, who spoke to FSRN from the protest Monday. She also participated in last week's People's Filibuster, which prevented the Republican majority from passing the bill.
We came in here and we stood our ground and sent the message that we're here to influence your opinion because you're here to represent us. And if you're not representing us, then we're not going to let you do business. So we're going to get in the way of that if we have to.
One of the most controversial provisions of the bill would require all doctors who perform abortions to obtain permission to admit patients at local hospitals. Dr. Ann Davis with Physicians for Reproductive Health explained why this may be impossible for many providers.
Sometimes at a hospital, you have to have a minimum number of cases per year to get privileges, so you just wouldn't meet the criteria because the surgery is so safe, you really wouldn't be over there very much, so they're not going to give you privileges because you're not going to work there enough. Or the hospital could politically say, no, the governor of the state called us up and told us that, this was a hot potato. We're certainly not going to give you hospital privileges because there'll be too many negative consequences for us. So basically, we've said no.
This same requirement was included in an abortion bill passed in Alabama that would have gone into effect on Monday, but a district court judge put a last-minute hold on the law after women's health and civil rights groups sued. Susan Watson with the American Civil Liberties Union says the measure would shut down three of the state's five remaining clinics, forcing many women to travel hundreds of miles to access the procedure.
It does prevent women their constitutional right to a safe and legal abortion. Low-income people, people of color, any woman would have been impacted, but certainly it would have had a harder impact on people that are low-income.
Watson will argue against the bill before the district court at a status hearing on Wednesday and will ask the judge to make his temporary